Please be seated. Good afternoon. We have our third TIS 1 and 2 case, 03-1276 Sierra State v. James Hubert Tucker, Jr. Arguing for Mr. Tucker is Assistant State Public Defender Donald T. Lang. Mr. Lang.
May it please the Court, Donald Lang appeared on behalf of the petitioner, James Tucker, Jr. This is yet another case that involves seeking a remedy for the sentencing disparity that occurred for TIS 1 and TIS 2.
We have a slight problem, Mr. Lang. The lights aren't on. The microphone is okay, but the lights are not. I see the marshal anxiously awaiting outside, entering the courtroom.
That's right. She'll fix us up.
Here we go. We got it.
Good. And Mr. Panya did a wonderful job.
Once again, Don Lang appeared on behalf of James Tucker, Jr. This case, again, poses another problem of the sentencing disparity that was created by the two-phase implementation of truth in sentencing. In particular, that individuals such as Mr. Tucker received sentences that were harsher than similarly situated offenders that committed their crimes both before and after TIS 1. The request for relief in this case, much like the request in Trujillo this morning, is very narrow. Essentially, what we're asking is that in those cases where a TIS 1 defendant received a term of incarceration greater than the maximum authorized under TIS 2, that in those instances, a new factor exists that allows but does not require a trial court to exercise its discretion to determine whether the sentence ought to be modified. As discussed earlier this morning, the issue in this case really comes down to a policy question for this court. This court has the inherent authority to modify sentences. The court defines what the scope of that authority is. The court can place the limits on what that authority is. When truth in sentencing was passed, the ultimate goal was to achieve certainty in sentencing, truth as they call it, so that a person sentenced to a particular period of time would serve each and every day of that time, and victims and DAs and judges wouldn't be surprised to find them out on the street earlier than that time. But truth in sentencing did not intend that people such as Mr. Tucker, who was sentenced in this interim period, will be serving more of such days than everybody else. That the question really posed here today is not whether the sentence should be certain, but what that certain sentence ought to be. And for the judges who are caught in the interim phase of truth in sentencing, who are compelled to apply new sentencing penalties under a new scheme, believing those penalties reflected the legislature's intent, that those judges should have the opportunity to address and revisit sentences imposed when those sentences exceed the new revised maximums. And again, let me say, this does not require any sentencing judge to modify a sentence. It really affords them the opportunity to reconsider those sentences.
And you take the position that the modification statute on sentencing does not apply. Do I have that correct?
The 973-195?
Right.
It's my position that it does not apply. Whether they had hoped that it would apply, and it would appear that that seemed to be one of the objectives. The problem is it's drafted so poorly it doesn't fit the TIS 1 defendants. Let me add, though, that whether it applies or not doesn't change my position in terms of whether this is a new factor or not. The authority of the court to modify a sentence derives from its inherent authority, and the legislature's passing of the sentence adjustment provision doesn't nullify that authority.
This is a unclassified offense.
That's correct.
Trujillo was a classified offense. Can you have a different result in, that is a different statement of the law in Tucker and Trujillo? What I'm saying, aren't they all going to both be governed by the same proposition of law?
The same proposition of law applies to both in terms of the new factor law.
That's right. And whether the trial court on remand would find it that it's applicable is not relevant at the moment. I mean, can you have inconsistent opinions in Tucker and Trujillo?
Our opinions are only inconsistent to the extent of what the appearance is as to whether the sentence adjustment statute applies at all. I think our positions are consistent that whether or not it does apply, assuming it does, that it's inadequate to achieve the solution to the sentencing mechanism.
Why would 973-195 apply in one and not in the other? Because of its unclassified?
My position is that it doesn't appear to apply to TIS-1 individuals because the classification scheme doesn't fit.
Okay.
And that burden of trying to fit them is even more problematic for the unclassified offender.
But isn't your argument, it seems to me, maybe I'm mistaken, aren't you talking about this TIS-1, which your client is, Mr. Tucker, as sort of a member of a class that all members should be treated equally? You look at the modification, new factors, that always was rather individualized. Now, if I get your argument, everybody, I think somebody had a graph here about 1,183 people that might be affected by this, but is it under our modification, our inherent powers, that we should be looking at this as a class?
Unless I hadn't thought of it as a class, but in effect, we have a class of offenders under TIS-1 who have maximums that are greater than the TIS-2 maximums.
Yeah, well, have we ever treated in criminal law people as a member of a class rather than individuals for a new factor, you know, for new factor jurisprudence? That kind of, because we're looking at your case, and it's individualized. And Mr. Tuck, but I sort of get the idea, or at least the argument is made, that, this is everyone that was unfairly sentenced under TIS-1 because in TIS-2 they lowered the sentences. In the prior sentencing, well, that would have applied and they might have had a different sentence, but in this one segment, this class. And I'm just saying that it seemed to me that under new factor, you're looking at the one individual, not everybody as a class.
Well, I think we have both things going on here, because new factor law has two steps in the process. We have an identifiable class of individuals who have a prima facie claim that they've been treated more harshly than similarly situated offenders as a group. Now, as we look at each case individually, once the case goes to the trial court, that may not be true on each particular case.
Isn't that always true, say, even before we had TIS, truth in sentencing, that people, you had people that were violated burglary, they had this and they were treated the same? No, potentially it was indeterminate sentencing, but here your argument is that for this time period, you said before, so that had to be prior to 1999 and after, which I assume is after February of 2003. So you're talking about that period of time that these people are being treated differently.
Yes, they were. And I think, harkening back to the argument made by counsel this morning for Trujillo, the premise for this claim in part rises from the linkage between the two phases of TIS, that this group that Mr. Tucker belongs to is a group that the legislature didn't intend to serve more time, that the reason they're serving more time was due to the peculiar political sort of gridlock that occurred that delayed passage of the sentence reduction in penalties and the reclassification of the penalties. So that the rule we ask for today is basically limited to that peculiar, unique group of individuals who basically represent a spike in penalties that wasn't necessarily intended by the legislature. The question that was posed this morning goes a little bit out of Hagrid and an argument about, well, gee, if the legislature didn't intend these penalties to be applied to these individuals, why don't they just make it retroactive? And on its face, it has a certain superficial appeal. In practical reality, it really can't be done. And there's a multitude of reasons. One is a sort of the preliminary difficulty of trying to track down who all these sentences were, identify them, bring them all back to courts for resentencing hearings. But that's really only the first level of problems. The second level of problems is that all these cases were resolved in reliance upon the penalties that existed at the time. And in my book, I have the situation of a prosecutor who entered a plea agreement willing to dismiss charges because he received a plea to a count that had, at that time, a 60-year sentence. He basically foregoed the opportunity to secure more punishment in exchange for this plea. For the legislature to belatedly say, well, we're going to knock those sentences all down to 40 years, undercuts the DA's prediction or assessment of the seriousness of the offense. The flip side, which I didn't even talk about in my brief, is the impact this would have on all the pleas that were entered from the defendant's perspective. If the defendant entered his plea believing the penalties were greater and then those penalties are retroactively reduced, one could argue that all those pleas are unknown and not voluntary because they're made with a misperception of what the maximum penalties were. So in terms of retroactivity being a remedy in any of these penalty reduction cases, it's frankly just isn't workable. I have a hard time imagining how the legislature would ever accomplish that end. That being said, the claim here isn't that he's entitled to any retroactive application. The claim is merely that the judge that imposed sentence under these temporarily inflated penalties ought to have the chance to look back at the sentence and determine whether it ought to be modified in light of the clarification of what the legislature's intent was.
This came up this morning, I believe, in one of the other arguments, but I think Justice Cripps had a good question that I'd like to follow up on. You talk in terms of it going back to the judge that imposed sentence, but in many jurisdictions throughout the state, you have judicial rotation where the case is not going to go back to the judge that did the sentencing. It's going to go to a successor judge. How would you apply it in that setting?
That's a very good question. And I guess one of the reasons why the new factor rule is necessary in the sentence adjustment statute is deficient, one of many reasons, is the notion of waiting years to go back. And quite frankly, for Mr. Tucker, for instance, a decade essentially is going to pass, and the judge who presided is not likely to still be on the bench, or there's a good chance he won't be. So ideally, we can try to get these back before the judges as promptly as possible. Okay, logistically, what's going to happen? I think basically, if the defendant has a sentence that exceeds the max, tis to max, he has a prima facie case. He files the motion. The judge who presides, whether it was a presiding judge or even a replacement judge, can look at the record and ascertain whether or not the judge at the time of sentencing considered the pending changes. If the judge did, there is no new factor because the change in penalties was considered at the time. If it is the sentencing judge still on the bench, the sentencing judge may be able to recall through his notes, ascertain whether he took into account those penalties. It may well be, as a matter of policy during this time, the judge was aware of those changes and was basically using those as a guide. But that would depend on what that judge did in those cases. In the instance of the replacement judge, he's going to have to exercise independent judgment about whether that change in penalties ought to make a difference, being guided by what the sentencing record was from the original sentencing judge. Again, if the original sentencing judge took it into account, then it's simply not a new factor.
Mr. Lang, I said to Ms. Hagopian this morning, and I'm going to say it to you, the public defender is taking a very narrow view that fits narrow interpretation of new factors that fits winning this particular case, but doesn't consider the broader issue that even if the initial sentence was less than the tis to maximum, the concept that the judge looked at what the maximum penalty at that time was is inherent in the whole concept of sentencing. The first thing you have to do is know what is the maximum, because that limits the judge's discretion, right? It's an illegal sentence if it exceeds the maximum, right? So the whole gravity of the offense and what the legislative maximum is has to be foremost in the judge's head when the judge does the sentencing. So to say that the penalty is not important and is just contrary to the whole concept of sentencing and just seems to turn this all on its head. And I was surprised when I came in today, although I shouldn't have been because there was a court order, to see Mr. Dickey sitting on that side of the table. I was wondering, whose friend is he? He's a friend of the court, and obviously the state has been courteous to give some time since the state has already had an hour on the issue, and I recognize that. But Mr. Dickey, who I assume is going to speak after you sometime, is going to take the position if he follows his brief, and not everyone has today, so he's not bound by his brief either. Is going to say that this is a any time you've got a change in the penalty, that's to be looked at. And I'm assuming, although I don't know, if you extrapolate from his brief, he's going to say, get rid of all this Rosada and all the other limiting factors on new factors and say, look, you got a whole new ball game now. So the court has to look at its inherent powers very differently. And you should do one case at a time, and if you're really applying Galleon, it's all going to work out under the concept of gravity of offense and under the concept, are you frustrating the original purpose of the sentence? Which is what I sort of expected you to say. So where have I gone astray, or where have you gone astray?
I don't think I've gone astray. I concur, basically, that the sentence is always relevant. The question really becomes, and as this is the way I start my argument, I guess, is ultimately this is a policy decision for the court. The court draws the lines where new factor time cuts will be allowed, where they won't be allowed. The group I represent, in terms of Mr. Tucker, obviously the reason I take this position in part is because Mr. Tucker's in this group, but the reality is he's in a readily identifiable group, one which I think we can all sort of agree that received a spike in penalties due to this two-phase implementation of TIS. He's a group that's identifiably punished more harshly than those sentenced before and after him. And it's a group the court can easily identify and apply. Could the court apply this to everyone sentenced under TIS 1 because the maximums have been reduced? The court could choose to do that.
Well, the degree of that was my question. I mean, then you're going to have the court. You have truth in sentencing now. I have to say honestly that the judiciary probably looked a little bit askance at that, but it's legislatively done. We have, as a court, an obligation to follow that. You're saying if we're going to look at everyone under TIS 1, and maybe they all can get their sentence reduced, and that's where I have a little trouble, because isn't the idea that truth in sentencing, you know what you're going to get, you're going to go before all these different judges, and they're going to give different considerations individually. So where's the...
And that's why this court can draw the line at only those who have received penalties that are more harsh than people before and after. And that's a reasonable group to employ a remedy to, because they are, in fact, the victims of a disparity in punishment. The others, some may not, and it's a more difficult line, and the court may have to draw that line because of the practical application would be much more difficult. Justice Dickey paints a pretty compelling picture of the scenarios that come up where we don't have a parole board or anybody to mitigate the impact of remarkable or extraordinary changes in circumstances. And as a matter of public policy, the court could choose to broaden trial court's authority to address those claims. Obviously, in Crozier, the court chose not to do that. There is a great qualitative difference, and I tried to spell that out in my brief, once the court goes down that road. there will be a type of fact-finding involved in those hearings that simply is not presented here. It's a pretty simple legal matter to ascertain whether or not this particular sentence was greater than the new maximum.
Counselor, could you construct an argument for me where we could conclude that the change in sentence between TIS 1 and TIS 2 was a factor, quote, highly relevant to sentencing, yet would have no relevance to those folks who got less than the max under TIS 2?
Well, it's always, even as to the group who got more than the max, it's highly relevant, but they may not necessarily be entitled to a time cut because there's a lot of other variables.
There are, but I'm looking at the factor that says it's highly relevant, so it's the first step in getting a sentence modification under a new factor test. And I'm trying to say how you could identify this change as a new factor for folks just because they were sentenced to more than the max under TIS 2 and not apply to those folks that got 6 months less than the max under TIS 2.
This is who has the authority to draw that line.
There's got
to
be a rational line.
The rational basis is that this identifiable group necessarily is punished more harshly, as a matter of course. The other group they may or may not, but as a matter of judicial administration, which is back in Hayes, one of the considerations the court had in defining the balance it's to strike in every instance, that's one line to be drawn. That's the one we propose. If the court wants to go beyond that and offer this to everyone who's sentenced under TIS 2,
Mr. Lang,
it certainly can.
Justice Rogensack's question, if I can follow it up, is that one of the factors that a court has to consider, any trial court considers at the time of sentencing, is the range and penalties that one has to work with. If the range changes, why wouldn't that still be a factor that a trial court consider? And I think that's where Justice Rogensack was going with
this. Exactly. I don't see any rationale logically to exclude one group if you're including another.
Well, I don't really disagree with your premise. It is a factor that every sentencing court must take into account is what the penalty range is. So is it a relevant factor in every case? Yes, it is. Is it one that warrants court intervention to remedy? That's for the court as a matter of policy to decide. Is there a rational basis to draw a line between those who receive more than or less than the maximum? I think there is. And the rationale is that Mr. Tucker, Mr. Trujillo this morning, and a group of other individuals that we've identified to some extent, there will be a group of those that receive more time, more days to serve than anybody wrote before and after, and that there was no rational basis for that to happen under any calculation.
How big is the group that Mr. Tucker is in?
We're not entirely sure. We submitted a outline of some offenses that are among the top offenses the DOC has identified. And the chart sets forth, I guess it was 1,183 people that received sentences greater than the TIS 2 max incarceration. Now,
but you would apply this to the people whose overall sentence exceeded that.
I haven't proposed that. My focus has been on the incarceration portion. And as I indicated, my brief is a little bit, again, policy, could you apply it to both? Sure.
Are you asking the court to set a hard line that covers on your chart 1,183 people, but doesn't cover those other 90 people whose overall sentence under TIS 1 is greater than it would be under TIS 2?
That's all we're asking on behalf of Mr. Tucker. If the court wishes to go further and it feels justice compels the additional remedy, the court certainly can do that. There's certainly good reasons why the court may want to do that. But
how many drug offenses do you think there are?
The total of all drug offenses was 4,379. The number I offered here, 1,183, which is the total that we have in our chart, when you start looking at the offenses, the freeing an officer, substantial battery, and operating without owner's consent, as a practical matter, the sentences in those cases are short enough that by this point, it's too late to offer them any remedy because they're going to have served those sentences. And so that the number, once you subtract those short offenses out, drops to 611, right off the top. Of the 4,379 drug offenses, how many of those have already been served? We're not certain. We couldn't really do a comparison because in the course of this change, the legislature also changed the substance of some of the crimes, so the comparison didn't work out very well in terms of the amounts possessed. Obviously, most of the possession offenses by now will have been served, and so those individuals won't be afforded any kind of remedy.
If 973, 195 were found to be retroactive to the TIS 1 people, how many times could a defendant raise this question of a reduction of sentence? Once or twice?
A good question, Your Honor. Justice Wilcox raised that this morning about the two kicks at the cat. I think, quite frankly, the court could determine if you raise the new factor claim based on the change in penalties and you lost or prevailed on that claim, that you could be a stop from bringing yet another claim on that ground. Now, the sentence adjustment statute offers different grounds for seeking a modification, which I don't think you'd be precluded from seeking to employ if that came up. The difficulty, of course, is my position is that the adjustment statute just is inadequate to address the problem created by the TIS 1, TIS 2, both because some people still have to serve over the max before they are eligible to apply. Some people, to the extent they serve the max till they apply, the litigation time will force them to serve beyond the max. There's a group of people who, well, basically something we talked about before is the ideal situation of having the judge who imposed the sentence be the judge who examines whether the sentence was appropriate. The sentence adjustment provision, by the time it applies, is going to be so many years down the road. The probability is there'll be a different judge trying to discern whether or not there's an intent to give less time. Another component for Mr. Tucker is he's got two separate sentences, so he'd have to go back twice for the same issue, once after he reached the 75% on the first case, and then he'd have to serve 75% on his second case to go back the second case.
Mr. Lang, I asked Mr. Freimuth this morning if the Department of Justice was doing anything to address this sentence disparity under TIS 1. And I got the answer that they didn't seem to be doing anything. What about the public defender? You folks have legislative programs all the time. You even bring them to the court once in a while to try to get lobbyists to help you.
Yeah, I mean, as a practical matter, unless we reinstitute a parole board, there really is no other way to rectify this. And for the reasons I stated earlier, there's no way to make the penalties retroactive in any meaningful way. So really, the only remedy is for trial courts to have the ability to reassess the wisdom of their sentence in the first instance. That trying to construct a remedy seems to be a problematic endeavor in any respect, unless we construct a new bureaucracy like a parole board to examine these offenses. And obviously that's what they're trying to eliminate, is having a bureaucrat outside the elected judicial process making these kinds of decisions.
Counselor, I have one other question I want to ask you that's a little different than we've talked about so far. Is it possible that this court could conclude that the sentence given was unduly harsh under our inherent authority by modifying somewhat our jurisprudence in that area, since this is the only time that I know of where a whole group of sentences that were given did not reflect the intent of the legislature?
Yeah, I know this question was posed this morning, and it's that avenue of analysis generally doesn't fit this problem. Judge Dillon, in deciding the post-conviction motion, frankly did an excellent job of discerning the difference from a judge's perspective of an unduly harsh analysis from a new factor analysis.
I know. That's something that shocks the conscience when it was given. I understand all of that, but I'm just asking you to look at it with fresh eyes, since we have a fresh problem.
It just, my first response is that it just doesn't seem to fit analytically very well. Because the trial judge did nothing wrong. The trial judge, given the information and the penalties he was given to work with, acted responsibly. And I think Judge Dillon's analysis of how he did his sentence, sort of taking this objective reflection back, or excuse me, objective view of what he did as opposed to reflecting on the wisdom of his sentence, mm-hmm. properly analyzed the case. If we were to take this approach and adopt some new, unduly harsh analysis, it would almost taint review then of unduly harsh cases. There's unduly harsh analysis, and then there's unduly harsh analysis in TIS 1 cases.
That's right.
Seems to be, another aspect here is procedural one, and that is the unduly harsh analysis is only available on an 8 or 930 direct appeal motions, so that anybody whose direct appeal time would have run basically would have no remedy to employ that.
Right, and there's the old 90-day rule that's working in the case.
I'm sorry,
you
can also bring that by way of 973-19, correct?
That's correct, yes, yeah. Right. But it would be both a direct appeal time limit, and as a practical matter, most people would already be past that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. Mr. Freimuth, you Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. You have 20 minutes, and you've ceded 10 to Mr. Dickey.
Your Honor, thank you. I feel a little bit in the position of a rebuttal from this morning, since our position is not going to change, as far as I can tell, and I haven't really had a sufficient time over the noon hour to really refine it. But I'll see if I can hit the high points of our position and answer perhaps some of the questions that have been posed Mr. Lang. The focus, I think, in the new factor discussion here has been on what did the legislature intend, and our position is that if the legislature really had meant for the TSI 1 offenders to make use of the reduced penalties, it would have said so, or it wouldn't have passed TIS 1 to begin with. I also think on the subject of whether or not a new factor application to this category of TIS 1 offenders could be so limited in the way that the public defender is suggesting. Obviously, from the state's position, that it would be more than, well, not even from the state's position, from a judicial position, from the trial court's position, a fewer number of cases to have to reconsider, would be better than a lot of cases or every case. But I don't see how, if you're going to say that the change in the TIS 2 maximums, the reduced maximums, is highly relevant, that why it wouldn't be that way across the board. And that's even a complicated further. I suppose you could have a situation where the person, TSI 1 offender, goes back to court, says, look, my sentence is equal to the maximum or above the maximum of TSI 2. And the court could say, okay, I'm not going to say that's highly relevant because, in my mind, the only relevant penalty that I was concerned about was the maximum penalty or the range of penalties that was in place when you committed that crime. And therefore, even though this is a new reduced maximum penalty, it's not highly relevant to me in what I was going to do with sentencing. So you could actually have, in the new factor analysis itself, on an individual case basis, a court coming in and saying, it's not highly relevant.
Mr. Freimuth, if I could, I'd like to refer to the law school brief that was authored and section 2 of that brief dealing with the new factors analysis, because it's my understanding, and I hope I'm not over-speaking for the law school, that the position that was taken in the front of the court brief was that perhaps this court got it wrong in Hegwood by confounding 990.04 with the new factor analysis. I don't know if you didn't argue that point this morning. I don't know what your position is regarding the position that was taken in the front of the court brief.
Our position is that we're looking at legislative intent, although actually a new factor doesn't have to necessarily do that. But I'm suggesting that in this area where we're looking at a legislative activity that affects a class of people, the TSI 2 reduced maximums, that it is valuable and it is important not to ignore that legislative intent. And with that in mind, if this court were to say that any TIS 1 offender, whether it's somebody who's got a greater sentence than the TIS 2 max or any TIS 1 offender, whether to allow them to be able to come back now and have the court reconsider that in light of the TIS 2 reductions, Is that really trumping what the legislature intended?
I guess my question really goes more to the heart of what Hagwood decided, because it based its decision on 990.04 and retroactive application. And if that indeed is not the same thing as the sentence modification analysis, in other words, if the court confounded the two, I think is the words that was used in the brief, if you take that confounding mechanism out, then wouldn't this be highly relevant, the sentencing range be highly relevant to the sentencing process?
I think I understand what you're saying. If I can paraphrase back to what I think you're saying is that the 990.04 retroactivity provision dealing with whether or not to make a change in the penalty retroactive or not, that's a legislative determination, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that change is or is not a new factor. But I'm suggesting, though, that in generally speaking, that when you think of a change in the reduction of a maximum penalty and it's across the board kind of thing, that the legislative intent is important and shouldn't be disregarded in that analysis. And I guess
so if you take 990 out of it and you start looking at legislative intent, I would assume from the state's perspective, the intent at best could be ambiguous given the arguments we heard this morning. From the state's perspective, at worst, the intent was not to increase penalties.
Well, except that, I mean, I think the best expression is what the legislature did, and in TSI 1, it clearly increased the penalties. I mean, I guess you could ask, because 3 years later in TSI 2, is that a sufficient or not insufficient amount of time to say that what was done in TSI 1 was not what they really intended? If they had waited 5 years or 10 years to do it, are we going to say that that should then be applicable because now the legislature has seen it differently? And my suggestion is that the courts should look at what was in place at the time that the penalties that were in place at that time.
How can you say, and I need to hear the reason, that what the legislature intended to do was to increase the penalties without adding on a sentence, but they also intended by appointing a criminal penalty study committee to reclassify and, for want of a better phrase, get things in balance, that indeed that's why they postponed the enactment, so that the criminal studies penalties committee recommendation in that endeavor could be enacted.
Sure. And the penalties committee actually issued its report, I think I indicated this morning, 4 months before TSI-1 offenses took effect. It just seems to me that if with the legislature, and I don't have intimate experience with the legislative process other than to suggest that it's complicated and there's a lot of different opinions going on, but they did not have to pass what they passed in TSI-1 if that was their intent. And they, that's fine. I lost my train of thought, actually, where I was going with
this. Okay, then let me interrupt your last train of thought.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean, my point is this, that they passed this legislation intending to stay off the effectiveness so that the Criminal Penalty Study Committee could be formed, come up with recommendations. They did that on August 31, 1999. As I understand it, both houses of the legislature passed recommendations, but in varying forms, and then it went into effect on December 31st, both parties having passed, with slight modification, the Criminal Penalty Study Committee. I mean, your argument is they intended that it go into effect on December 1st. I think by the very fact, not by the very fact, they indicated that by delaying and appointing the Penalty Study Committee and wanting them recommendations and redoing the sentencing structure before the implementation, that was their intent. It just didn't happen.
The other aspect of this, I mean, apart from the fact that it then took them 3 years to do what it did, is that if this court was inclined to look at the 973.195, the sentence adjustment statute, as a legislative answer to softening, if you will, the change in the law, there would have been, if they really were thinking in terms of, that this is what they wanted to do, I mean, that to have the new factor apply would basically remove that part of that statute. I mean, that statute would be pretty much meaningless. Anybody could bring a new factor motion based on the TIS-2 reduced maximum at any point in time, and there's no reason to wait 75-85%. I mean, that provision wouldn't have any effect with respect to if that's what
we're intended. Isn't the difference between the two, now maybe I'm getting it wrong, but I thought the difference between the two is that under the new factor analysis, you have to first determine that it's highly relevant, which a court might not conclude, and second, that it was not used at the time either because it was not in existence or because it was unknowingly overlooked by the party.
Right.
Whereas under the statute, you don't need either of those. All you have to do is wait till you get to 75-85% and bring your motion, and the court can make its decision without the benefit of that analysis. Is there a fundamental difference in the approach there?
I guess I don't see it necessarily. If your new factor motion is that the TSI-2 reduced maximum penalties is why that was highly relevant, and that's the basis for my new factor, is that legislative change, then it seems to me that you wouldn't need that part of that statute
to deal with. But on the statute, you don't have to have a new factor. All you have to have is the legislative change. So the legislature changed the law. Now I'm at 3/4. Judge, give me a break.
Right. It could, but if the change, if the sentence adjustment motion, the one that's based on the statute, is brought by the inmate, and that sentence adjustment motion is based on this current change in the law, in other words, the TSI-2 reduced maximums, then that would, if you're going to have a new factor, then that would not be available. The statute, I guess, could still be available for changes in the law other than the TIS-2 change in the law. But I don't see it as, if this court is going to say new factors available to any TSI-1 offender or TSI-1 offenders whose sentences are above the maximum for TSI-2, it seems to me that with respect to the sentence adjustment statute, that becomes moot with respect to truth in sentencing changes in the law, this change in the law. That's how I read it.
I think we're talking past each other because I think under the new factors, there's a certain analysis and a certain degree of discretion that has to be exercised. And as I understand the statute, that it's more or less you can bring it because you're there.
Right.
The court doesn't have to go through the same analysis. The court doesn't have to apply the same legalistic approach to determine whether or not it's highly relevant to the sentencing process. And if the court chose to change its mind and reduce the sentence, it can do so without new factor grounds under the statute. Am I correct?
That's correct.
So that's the difference.
Sure. But where I'm going with this is to say that provision would have no meaning in the TIS-2 situation of applying the new factor analysis, because why wait that long? Why even bother with that statute? If as a matter of law it's going to be a new factor, automatically because it's a reduced maximum.
Counselor, if we were to decide that it is a new factor highly relevant to sentencing, what would that do to all the pleas that were made under TIS-1?
That's a good question. I think there's some concern there that, I'm sorry, I haven't thought it through as thoroughly as I probably should have in advance. I know in the brief I discussed it. Certainly from the expectation of the parties during plea negotiations, I think you start with, this is what you could get.
Exactly.
And so, and I'm not familiar enough with the Dahlke, and again, I apologize, but there's some concern here. Dahlke was a case, I think, where this court held the defendant to what he had negotiated and was not going to go back and, upset that. So certainly if you had a situation of the defendant who agreed to a sentence that was above what is now the TSI-2 maximum, and I think the public defender has conceded the point that defendant shouldn't be given relief based on what he or she did. As to others, it certainly calls into question those, at least from the state's standpoint, the liability of those agreements. If you look at contract principles, you're changing now the lay of the land after the fact.
Right.
Beyond that, I haven't a more complete answer.
Thank you.
Mr. Farnworth, let me ask you, if 973.195 indeed applies to TIS-1, do you have any suggestion how the court would handle unclassified offenses?
I think the public defender's suggestion probably is the way you would do this, and that is these are mostly in the drug category. You look at what the penalty was under TIS-1, and see where that penalty fits in the TSI-2 class. I think this works pretty much for, and even for the Class Bs, it works. You would take the Class B penalty of the TSI-1 guy, and then and I think that's been divided up in TSI-2 into two categories anyway. But there are, I think there's two unclassifieds that got overlooked that are still left, and that those would be oddball situations that would still, that wouldn't, there'd be no, yeah, there's, they're even unclassified still today.
I'm curious, which two are those?
They're in the brief.
All right. I'll find it. I'll find it.
They're not in the criminal code. They're in some other areas that, not in the criminal code. See if I can remember what I was. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
If one is using, if 973-195 is retroactive to TIS-1, what sentence do you use to calculate the 85%?
Right, and I think the only way that probably, or the easiest way that works is you would, even though this TSI-1 offender was sentenced under a certain classification, in order to apply the statute, you'd have to translate that classification to the TSI-2 one. So, for example, in other words, to determine whether you're in the C to E category or the F to I category, you take the TIS-1 crime, you and the maximum for that crime, see where it fits in the TSI-2 classification, as I understand it, and then look at where that fits. So most of the, well, I'd say most of the time, so that the 75 or 85% figure is going to be based on what the crime is in TSI-2, even though it's a TSI-1 offender. This is part of the problem, I think, with why this is, I mean, it's doable, but for everybody to have figured this out and do it on their own, I think, is to have asked a lot of everybody below. But that's the way you would do it. It's, I think you take the TSI-1 class, look at that penalty, see what it is now in TSI-2, determine that classification, say that's Class F, then for Class F, it's the 75%, I think, that you can bring it in, and that's where you would, how you do it. That's part of the reason why I was resistant here to suggest that, entirely at least, that this sentence adjustment statute was the answer to the the amelioration.
It's not really so hard. Public defender's office can do a chart in probably a couple of hours.
That would be great. That would be great.
And hand it out to the prisoners, and they'd be in great shape. I mean, it's not, because the prisoner has no right to a lawyer, at least under 973-195. So you could handle that.
It seems to me an inmate who is serving a sentence imposed under 973-01, you're only serving one sentence. And then it talks about percentage of the sentence. That's going to be a different sentence.
Yeah, I agree there is a problem of translation here. I don't know how to explain it other than that there's a problem. And you'd have to overcome that language. There would be some rewriting that the court would have to do if it wants to make that statute applicable to TIS-1.
Well, that's why you and Mr. Lang agree.
Well, we agree for different reasons, of course, right. And that is because of the how we view the new factor analysis in part. But
right. But you agree as to the system, the inapplicability of the statute because of its language and its...
The one thing that I did mention in the brief, and we did discuss, and I don't know how far this is an answer to it, and that is the unduly harsh motion. And that might be at least one way of addressing some of this. It may mean refining the meaning of unduly harsh, at least other than the non-constitutional meaning. It clearly says you can have a sentence that's unduly harsh because it's unconstitutionally cruel and unusual punishment, too harsh that way. But you can also have an unduly harsh sentence because the way the exercise of discretion was made that it was still unfair. And I suppose a defendant could craft a theory that the TIS-2 reduced maximum now means that if he got, at least for those certainly that were imposed above that maximum, could say that's unduly harsh because now our lawmaking public body here has said that that's beyond what we think should be the maximum for
that analysis, though, seems to me that it would include, I get back to the Class B felons. I mean, if you're going to say it's unduly harsh because the sentence imposed exceeds the maximum of TIS-2, and so that would mean that you would have a finding with regard to the first-degree reckless homicide, the first-degree sexual assault, some of the more severe crimes that we see. I mean, these are the Class B, you know, they're just under intentional homicide, first degree, that those would per se be unduly harsh under that analysis? Am I making myself clear? In other words, those with the most, the worst crimes, if you will, that analysis would apply to them too, not just what's under the statute that we have before us.
Right. No, I'm saying this is, when I'm saying unduly harsh, I'm not limiting it to any particular class of offender.
If you take the unduly harsh approach, I would suggest that all you're doing is you're substituting, opening up new factors and opening up unduly harsh. The result is that you're adding to the inherent power the four previously stated inherent power by opening up either one of the two criteria.
I know what you're saying. Yeah, I think that may be the case. And I guess maybe the only difference...
The question is easier, what makes more sense, what works better.
Well, my guess is that if this court were to declare the TSI-2 reduced maximums a new factor, that would invite defendants and all TSI-1 offenders to come back and seek.
If they're still in custody, or maybe even extended supervision.
I'm sorry?
If they're still in custody, or maybe even extended supervision. Because if they breach the extended supervision, they got a little problem.
Sure. I mean, and I was just going to say, in an individual case, this may not be, problematic, but when you start mounting numbers, I mean, but even then, I suppose, the court could just say, this is what the penalty range was, this is what I intended to do, doesn't affect my opinion. But
Mike, Chief? Isn't one of the other problems with the unduly harsh approach that what you're really saying, and at least the argument, is that the trial court erroneously exercised its discretion when, in fact, it did not do that. It exercised its discretion based upon the law at the time. And isn't it, from at least a pragmatic approach, easier to get at the issue by calling it what it is, something new?
Right. I understand what you're saying. I think you get to the same place. I mean, I think when you get to the second step of the new factor, the court's going to say, this is what I intended to do right along, and this doesn't make any difference to me. And even though it exceeds the maximum for TSI-2, I don't see it as this is what I wanted to do and this is it. You're probably right in that respect. I mean, and I guess I haven't thought through the difference between unduly harsh and new factor to say which one of these is the way to go. Other than that, it just seems to me that if you're going to say this is a new factor, this TIS-2 reduction, it's inconsistent with Crozier. Because in Crozier, rehabilitation is a primary sentencing factor as well. And this court said in Crozier that we're categorically going to say that's not a basis for a sentence modification based on new factor.
Under either unduly harsh or new factor, any change in the prior law will rely on the fact that TIS 1 and 2 are so different. That's where the linkage comes in. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Freund.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Dickey, University of Wisconsin Law School, amicus.
Thanks for having me. I'd like to take up the invitation in one of the court's opinions to take a step back from all of the sentencing stuff and try to look at and think about the bigger picture, because I think that's absolutely essential to what the court's about today. And in an effort to do that, I'd like to make three or four brief points that I think are central to that taking a step back. First of all, the mythology around truth in sentencing and its history is growing every day. There's more mythology about the intent of the legislature than there is fact in history. First of all, truth in sentencing wasn't principally about finality. It was about legitimacy. It was about legitimacy because what drove it was the need to restore legitimacy, because sentences, duration, length, content were being decided by the parole board, not in open court, not on facts found by judges, not on facts announced, not on facts about which the parties might disagree and argue, but in a sense in closed session, and the effort was to restore legitimacy. Now, to be sure, finality is an aspect of it, but only an aspect of it, and I think legitimacy is far more important here. Now, I say that because I think sentencing was in disrepute because of its lack of legitimacy, and I think it continues. And I really think that this court can take a big step forward today in starting to fix that. Why does legitimacy matter? I think legitimacy matters because the people who we're trying to influence with the sentences, those being sentenced, have to believe they're being fairly treated, legitimately treated, if we think they're going to change their behavior because of the sentence. Second, legitimacy is important to the rest of us, because to the extent we're expected to comply with the law, a large measure of compliance comes when we believe the law is fairly made and decisions are fairly arrived at. And I think truth in sentencing has more to do with those kinds of matters than it has to do with finality. Now, with respect to that, what gives legitimacy to a court's sentencing decisions? I would say it's principally facts. Facts matter. Sentences that aren't based on facts lack moral legitimacy. Now, why? Because facts are the moral basis for the distinctions we make among offenders. They're the reasons that this person deserves more or less time than this other person, because of facts relating to the moral wrong that they did. Now, therefore, facts really are the basis for the moral distinctions that are being made in sentences. And it seems to me facts have to be fairly arrived at. They have to be anchored in a reasoning process, and they have to be anchored in moral judgments announced publicly in open court. Now, I think currently trial courts are confused about sentences to modify, because I would say there are almost two lines of cases coming out of this court on sentence modification. The first line is the Hayes line that says justice matters. Justice includes legitimacy. Hayes says it's better to have a little uncertainty, but get the facts and the sentence right. And I think a lot of trial courts in this state read Hayes, read about the inherent authority of a court over its sentence until its expiration, and think they're in the business of doing justice when offenders come before them and ask for their sentences to be modified. And I think a lot of those are under the radar and, frankly, are contrary to this court's new factor jurisprudence. They're not appealed, maybe because the prosecutor doesn't have the time, but maybe because the prosecutor agrees. They don't rise up to any appellate level because people are satisfied with the result that they believe is just. But there's a second line of cases. The second line of cases goes through the new factor stuff, right? And I have to say it sort of reached the point where it looks to me like just a bunch of magic words. These are inventions. We call this a new factor. We don't call that a new factor. But there's really not a lot of principle basis for distinguishing one thing from another. Conscientious judges following that jurisprudence feel limited in doing justice, because there are pronouncements of this court that say this is a new factor, that's not a new factor, they find themselves trying to squeeze things into categories or find themselves unable to consider morally relevant facts that it would influence how they would alter a sentence because they believe they've been told by this court that they're not permitted to do so. Now, I think sentencing is kind of at a low point in our state, though I think it's much improved, frankly, by the decision in Galleon. I frankly think Crozier was a stumble, and I think it ought to be corrected. Here's what I think the court should do. I think, first of all, it ought to abandon magic words, and I think it ought to abandon new factors and a lot of these kinds of things that really don't have any principally inherent sort of basis. I think, rather, we ought to have no categorical exclusions because we ought to allow trial courts, they're the people best positioned, to decide when facts are highly relevant and when they frustrate the purpose that they had at sentencing. And if they decide that the facts are not highly relevant and don't frustrate their purpose, they shouldn't be modifying the sentence or even considering it. But when they think it may be true, they ought to have the discretion to hold a hearing to determine whether the facts are highly relevant, whether they frustrate the court's purpose, and whether the sentence ought to be modified. Now, I think Galleon really set the basis for this, because Galleon requires the facts to be found, the purpose to be stated, and the reasoning process to be put on the record. Therefore, the more of that is done, the clearer it's going to be what the court's reasoning process was and what the facts are and what the relevant facts are and what aren't relevant, and the easier it's going to be for them to make decisions actually fairly quickly about whether to even consider modifying a sentence based on factors that appear or do not appear to be relevant or highly relevant.
Mr. Dickey, if I could, if I heard you correctly just now, you've indicated that perhaps we should move away from the new factor analysis. Now, for purposes of this question, should this court decide that it is not going to do that? Is it still your, did I read your position correctly in the brief that the position of the law school, the position that you advance, is that the court got it wrong in Hegwood?
Yes. But the only thing I'd say about that, Justice, is I don't think the law school wants me speaking for them. Yeah, I think you need to reverse Hegwood.
Okay. An issue that I think a trial judge might say, if the trial judge was sitting here, would say, okay, sounds right. We're going to let trial judges, trial courts use their inherent power to modify sentences on the basis of the facts as shown in the original sentence and whether something has happened to frustrate that purpose. But I'm a trial judge now in Milwaukee, and I have sentenced, you can pick a number, over the 2 years or 4 years that I'm in felony court. And what I hear you saying has deals with everybody under TIS 1, TIS 2, TIS 5. And therefore, I am going to be inundated within 20 minutes after that decision is mandated with a lot of people saying, okay, I want a modification because you gave me 150 years, right? And that is just a huge number of cases and quite a change in the business of the trial courts of the state. So, you could tell me, well, it's justice that matters, not the floodgates. But you and I both know courts do look at floodgates. And sometimes they'll say, oh, we can't handle it, and other times they'll say, well, heck with that. Just give us double the number of judges. You don't want a parole board? We'll do it.
Sure. A couple things, Justice Stevenson. First of all, if it's 150 years, I think it's worth a little more reflection. But it may not be worth much, and there's certainly no requirement that it be a hearing or the like. Secondly, inmates are going to be asking for modifications of their sentence. They're going to be trying to squeeze them into categories as long as you have categories. And I think that's going to impair the capacity of the courts to deal with them. But I am not going to stand here and say that inmates aren't going to bring those kinds of motions. However, I don't think the test that I've proposed, highly relevant and frustrates the purpose, is just an open-ended test that anybody can drive right through. It has to be highly relevant. There ought to be a burden on somebody who's going to claim that to show why it's highly relevant and why it frustrates the purpose. And if it's one in which, as you say, a lot of time has passed and I don't remember, then basically what you're going to look at is the record, right? And you're going to make a decision about whether or not this claim has been made does do that. Yes, there are going to be claims made. I don't view this as sort of opening up a hole that everybody's going to be able to drive through. I think, on the contrary, this is a pretty good test. And I think it's really anchored in what I said was sort of moral facts. And I think that's what really matters.
Could I ask you where Wisconsin stands among all of the states? Do most states have something like Hegwood, or do most states have something like Hayes?
No, I think Wisconsin is very unique in a couple different respects. The first is the continued jurisdiction over the sentence until its expiration is very uncommon. Therefore, in lots and lots of states, there's a point at which it's over. Although there are all kinds of tricks that courts use in order to keep that from being true. Secondly, in a lot of states, there's not been a holding like ours that courts have got inherent authority to modify the sentence. And that also is uncommon. As an example, though, of what I said was the sort of trickery that people use, one of the common ways this is dealt with in a way to allow the court to continue to have jurisdiction was actually how the Watergate defendants were handled. See, there was I think it was 30 days at the time limit on continued federal jurisdiction over their sentence, except if a motion had been made and not decided, the motion lay open until it was decided. And what the practice was everybody filed a motion within the first 30 days. There was an unstated agreement to not decide them until plenty of time had passed. Then they'd be decided at some time down the road when there was time for reflection and to see how things had worked out and to see the kinds of things that courts thought were relevant. So they were finding, I think what you find is people finding back doors, again, for the kinds of purposes that I was mentioning. And that's how the Watergate defendants all got their sentences modified. It was under that hole in the federal statute that appeared to say they lost jurisdiction after 30 days.
Under the test that you propose, you seem to be suggesting that not all that many defendants would actually get sentence modifications. But what about just the flood of filing and the flood or the burden of dealing with all those filings?
Well, I say again, I think if the lawyers who represent them are behaving responsibly, they're not filing cases where there isn't a prima facie case that it's highly relevant and frustrates the purpose of the sentence. In the cases,
in the age of pro se.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I know. That's what I was going to say. The pro se ones are the ones that you're going to worry about, right? As you'd expect. And then there's going to have to be a factual claim on its face, right, that is what is true, just the way the claims to new factors are made right now. And most of them are dismissed without a hearing. I think that's the way that these ones would be handled.
Now, under your test, in this case where the defendant got more than the TIS 2 max, would you say that on its face that would fit into highly relevant?
No, I wouldn't. And the reason I say that is this. First of all, I think it's surely relevant because I think the maximum is always relevant for the reasons we stated in our brief. It's a reflection of the gravity of the offense. But in many ways, I think cases in, like this one, where the old maximum was imposed and now the new maximum is lower, in some cases, in some ways is a weaker case for considering modification than the other cases. And the reason I say that is this. At the moment the judge imposed the sentence, which was in excess of this new maximum, what the judge was saying is the norms of our community require the maximum sentence to be imposed, and those are the norms that exist right now. Now, if the judge, if the legislature turns around and changes the maximum, in a sense saying the norms are now different, I think a judge is certainly permitted to examine his reasoning process to determine whether it's highly relevant and frustrates his purpose, but is certainly not required to do so. Because what the judge was doing was making a decision about the norms as he was going to reflect them in his sentence at the moment the crime was committed, and that was a time when the maximum was what it was. But I think it's harder when it's actually a lesser sentence.
But that's the defendant's position here and in Trujillo, namely, just because it's in excess of TIS 2 doesn't mean you're going to modify it. But what they want to say is at least you ought to have the judge look at it.
I think the judge is certainly entitled to look at it, but I don't think he's required to. And I don't think he's required to hold a hearing because I think he can find from this, the process of reasoning that he used that it wasn't highly relevant and doesn't frustrate his purpose. As I said, I think the harder case is suppose when we had the seminar for sentencing judges in Wisconsin, some of them talked about going through a sentencing process in which they said, I start in the middle. Right? I start in the middle between the minimum and the maximum. And then I move based on aggravating and mitigating circumstances. Now, if that's true, and the maximum's 20, and the judge starts at 10 and starts to move, right, and says, because I think that's my responsibility. Now the maximum's been changed from 20 to 10, right? And now the judge is sort of asked the judge, well, now if you were sentenced that person, where would you be starting? You'd be starting at 5. Now, they may have gone to 10 with it, right? But it seems to me in many ways that's a more compelling case for it may be highly relevant and frustrate the purpose. But highly relevant and frustrate the purpose is a fact-rich question. Right? It's based entirely on facts that are morally relevant. And as I said, the sentencing judge is the person best positioned to make that decision.
This is a follow-up, I think, of what the Chief was asking earlier. But you speak of the Hayes opinion and that justice matters. I reflect on the Floodgate opinion and the Floodgate argument. I mean, justice matters also if the trial courts and the judges are inundated with motions to modify sentences. As things may have changed a lot in the last 10 years, when I was on the trial bench from 85 to 95, the genre of motions to modify would be from prisoners who have seen the light, you know. And those were easy for me to handle because it's not a new factor, seeing the light. And, that wouldn't take long at all. I don't mean that to sound so callous. I'm speaking, I guess, the way that I sometimes happen. I'm concerned. I'm really concerned that if we go as broadly as you are suggesting, I'm concerned about the floodgate approach. I'm concerned that justice won't be able to be done because it's going to be too taxing on the system. And so what we've done, of course, is taken a parole board and now made our judges de facto parole boards. They are ill-equipped to do it in terms of experience, and they are ill-equipped to do it in terms of resources. It's like the worst of all worlds.
A couple things, Judge. First of all, we're at a low point in sentencing, and it's taken us a while to get here. It's going to take us a while to get back to a better place. Now, as I said, I think we started on that process by your decision in Galleon, because there you talked about the importance of fact-rich decisions, the reasoning process, and identifying the purpose. See, I think when that's done, and it's done over time, and that is monitored, that's going to make these sentence modifications far more easier to decide. Secondly, I guess I can't say I would accept, because it makes it easier for us to check a box and say it's not a new factor. It excuses me from coming to grips with the facts. And again, I'm inclined to say words like rehabilitation are empty phrases. I don't know in many ways what it is people mean when they're talking about that. I found, frankly, the example we gave in our brief very compelling, where, as we hypothesize, somebody not able to control themselves and not able to be controlled is put in prison because that seems to be the only means we can get to control the person. They're diagnosed with ADD, and medication turns out to really control the impulses that are leading them to act out. Now, I don't know what you call the fact that they've now been diagnosed and are now taking this medication such that they don't appear to need the controls of the prison anymore. But those are a set, it seems to me, of what I'm talking about when I say morally relevant facts. And I don't think that it'd be a good place to be to have boxes to check to say we need not consider that when we try to when we reconstruct as we will. What we thought were the relevant facts and what the purposes of the sentences were and whether or not these newly found facts are relevant to it. I think it's our job to do those things.
Are there any other questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Dickey. Before you begin, Mr. Lang, we're going to have to change our recording disk, so if you'd give us a couple of minutes, we'd appreciate that.